We're here at the Monument de la Renaissance Africaine in Dakar. It's the tallest statue in Africa. It's 171 feet, 52 meters, and speaks to high hopes for a continent so long held back by everything from geography to colonialism to the Soviet economic model enforced by Cuban troops. But the statue shows these Africans escaping from things that are trying to hold them back. And unfortunately, one of those now is a new breeding kind of imperialism in which do-gooders in Western countries are working very hard to deny Africans the ability to develop the energy resources that will make a true, indigenous, lasting, and meaningful renaissance possible on this continent.
We've come to the Guéjouy district of Dakar to talk about poverty in Senegal, in Africa, and in too much of the world. Or, more exactly, to look at it. And I can tell you that Senegal has a GDP per capita nominal of somewhere around $1,800 US, and that the purchasing power parity number is somewhere around $4,000. And I can even tell you that someone did a Gini coefficient and said that it has moderate inequality. Really? What's the Gini coefficient of this? How much faith do you really have in GDP statistics in Senegal? How much of the activity here is off the books? But what you can see here is that there are a lot of things in the way of these people making their lives better.
We decided to be in a village. Everybody who goes back home, the few who go back home to build a company, they all go cluster themselves into the capital city. It's because everything is in the capital city. All these government agencies that you're going to have to deal with are in the capital city. Better employees, better everybody is going to be in the capital city. Meanwhile, our countryside is being emptied.
Poverty is solved by prosperity, not poverty alleviation. The goal should not just be to be a little bit less poor. That's nonsense. The prosperity is built by entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs need an enabling business environment, as well as, again, access to affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources.
And what is it that you make here?
We create skincare products.
So I was reading this very strange piece in The Economist, and they were all enthused about the African diaspora, because they said more and more of the working age people in the world are African, and a lot of them are going to come to other countries to work, because in Africa, 15 million people roughly enter the workforce each year, but there are only 3 million formal jobs. Yeah. What a nightmare for all these young people looking to build a career, get some equity, support a family, and they're stuck in the informal sector where none of that happens.
It tells you everything you need to know. Bottom line is, the world has given up on Africa. All of those people who have co-opted the concept of caring about Africa and Africans, what you're trying to push for, she's net zero, you know, truly by tomorrow. And insofar as you're telling me, because Earth is at risk a few years down the line, unless we stop everything now, meaning Africans absolutely cannot touch fossil fuels, then you're telling me it is okay for you, for people to continue dying. This is people who are energy poor. You've come around here, are you seeing socialism around you? You see people at market, everybody's selling you something. It's capitalism everywhere you turn around here. Everywhere. Everybody is hustling. The socialism mindset is a colonial import.
All right. Well, thank you very much, because Africa needs three things. It needs economic freedom, more energy, and more people like you. And here we come to one of the paradoxes of development, because it seems it's not just very hard to know what you should do, it's apparently very hard to know what you shouldn't do. When you look at scenes like this, a lot of people say, what we need is more foreign aid. But probably, in fact, what we need is less foreign aid.
There's an old jibe that foreign aid transfers money from poor people in rich countries to rich people in poor countries, which I've seen variously attributed, including to Lord Peter Bauer. And this problem is worse than it seems, because to the extent that third world governments that pursue exotic first world or second world projects are decoupled from the need to get revenue from the domestic tax base, they're freed both from direct political accountability and from the indirect accountability that comes from only getting enough revenue to do what you want from a flourishing economy if the people in your nation are prospering by doing what they want. One 2021 effort to survey what development leaders really want addressed, and climate change was not near the top, listed dozens of them, from the Asian Development Bank to ASEAN, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Caribbean Development Bank, the China International Development Cooperation Agency, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, yes, it's still around, the European Union, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Finance Corporation and the International Monetary Fund, and the OECD, the United Nations Development Programme, UNESCO, and the World Bank. Arguably, these people don't have much to show for 8 decades of do-gooding, but is there a single one of them today that's not obsessed with climate change? Or statism? And is there a single one that's really driven by the needs and wants of those on the ground? In the Wall Street Journal in December 2024, Bjorn Lomborg underlined the size and the shiftiness of their commitment.
So here's a small but telling example. The blackout problem at Dakar has actually gotten a lot less serious recently. I was talking to somebody who grew up here and they said when they were a kid, power would go off all the time. You know, it'd be gone for 12 hours and then, yes, it's back. Oh, it's gone again. But now that's unusual, maybe once a year. And one of the reasons why is that ship out there. That's been out there for 3 years, supplying LNG to the city, which helps to keep the lights on. And you know, Western alarmists hate natural gas. They say, oh, it's 25 times worse than CO2, or it's 80 times worse. They don't even want it used to replace coal. They're purists and must have solar panels. So, do you really want to tow that ship out of Dakar Harbor and tell these kids here on the beach that they're going to grow up in the dark without the fridge working? And maybe having the power go off at the hospital in the middle of a procedure? That's the kind of misplaced priority, a failure to understand the trade-offs that makes Western environmental policy so dangerous to people in 4 countries.
Just how bad is it? Well, we're going to show you some of the nitty-gritty in this film. But while precise numbers differ, and some of the agencies make a fuss about sustainability at the expense of switch-on-ability, the general consensus is that around 1 billion people worldwide have no electricity at all. Over half of them in sub-Saharan Africa, where over half the people have no such access. Of course, to get a proper look at the issue, we had to get into rural Senegal. In this case, a village close enough to see the power lines and with the zealots' cherished solar, which shuts off when the sun goes down, though our car could barely make it up the sand road to a place whose location few people seem to know, though when we got there, our host Magat Wade showed us the kind of conditions that she grew up with here in Senegal.
I mean, seriously? Yeah. And you see how hot it is?
It was some cold water so that it doesn't burn me.
Okay, so you see no more water. At least they have a... This faucet, because none of the homes has running water. So this is a shower area. I would do open privacy. Mm-hmm. Got it? Right? And now I'm showering. And on this side here usually would be where you go to the bathroom.
In addition to creating jobs and wealth here in Mekki, Wade has also had a school breakout inside her house.
For any community to thrive, you have to have 2 major solid anchors. One is education, another thing is jobs. If you don't have either of those, you can't build a community because people will have to go, especially for those who are out there. Always talking about how, supposedly black people are low IQ, black people are inferior because it's in their genes, whatever. Lee Kuan Yew was famous for saying that access to AC, thanks to affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources, he believes has raised the IQ of Singaporeans by at least 3 points. I would challenge everybody in here, anywhere around the world, to go and try to do math problems and certain things in 100 degrees constantly for hours. You come back and you tell me what you're able to do. So that is another reason why affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources matter. This should not be political. This should not be... just like we need this air to breathe and just to be alive.
We're here in Saint-Louis, the former capital of colonial French West Africa. And apparently, we're in a lot of danger. We've got to stop fussing around and finish this shot before we're engulfed by the rising oceans. Unless that's just tide coming in. But the climate alarmists assure us that it's not, including The Economist, which has a bit of a thing about Senegal and indeed about Saint-Louis. They tell us the Venice of Africa is sinking into the sea. And that's an important part of a claim that even though Africa is poor, it should forego the development advantages of fossil fuels because otherwise they'll bring doom down on themselves. Now, even if there were some merit to that argument, surely it would be a lot more compassionate and even efficient for wealthy countries to give up some of the benefits of fossil fuels and let Africans get out of poverty before they start worrying about a fraction of a degree temperature-wise.
And now I want to introduce you to a very brave man, Issa Koyate, who runs a refuge for street kids in Saint-Louis.
It's an inspiring story, but it's also a depressing tale about how energy poverty in rural Senegal and the resulting lack of schools and jobs sees so many boys sent to the cities to beg while the girls left behind are pressed into polygamous marriages with men often four times their age. Of course, there are people productively employed here, as we understand that term, from those working in construction to the people fishing out of Saint-Louis. But too many of them are not, with consequences as strange as they are pernicious. In some ways, much of Senegal is actually a garbage dump. There's an incredible amount of waste plastic here. And here again, I got to thinking about Britain and the Industrial Revolution.
Because, of course, the Industrial Revolution in England, though it brought a sustained and dramatic improvement in living standards, also created a kind of grimy poverty on an industrial scale and a lot of pollution. But one thing about all that, both the prosperity and the pollution, is it was domestically generated and then it was domestically dealt with. But the things that you see here seem to have washed up from all around the world, and I don't know how on earth they're ever going to clean it all up. But I'll tell you one thing that's a key part of our story. They're not going to clean it up by staying poor. We're here at the Banja Nature Reserve to see some of the magnificent creatures for which Africa is so justly famous. And it's obvious that part of the plan for sustainable prosperity in Senegal is ecotourism. But of course, as so often, there's a perilous interaction here between poverty and development. If they get it right, then they preserve the habitat, they prosper, they clean up the country, and they can protect these animals and the places they live so that the big and the small can flourish. But if they get it wrong, then you get a spiral downward as people encroach on the habitat and kill the animals or drive them off. I mean, people who need firewood for breakfast tomorrow can't think about the state of the environment 10 years from now. And people who are hungry are going to go and get themselves some bushmeat. When countries start to develop, at first, there is a more and more environmental damage. They're exploiting the resources and getting food on the table and not worrying either about pollution or about habitat loss. But then at a certain point, and it was around $5,000 per capita GDP, at least back in the 1990s, the curve of rising prosperity and rising environmental harm does a U-turn, because they reach a point where they can afford to care about the environment and they can afford to do something about it. So, it's crucial not to try to impose policies on Senegal and other countries like it that will derail or deform development.
And as we wrap up, the most important thing about this trip and everything that we've seen and heard is that these interrelated problems of poverty and of economic development and of energy are not an academic exercise, where if you get it wrong, you might get a C on a term paper. These are real people with real and complicated lives, often lived under conditions of almost unimaginable hardship. So, if you want to do good for poor people in the world, especially if you want to do it with tax money that you got from somebody else. You better understand the implications of your actions, because these people can have a brighter future, and they should have.